Parshas Toldos, the first major episode, is after the birth and pregnancy and birth of the twins, Yaakov and Esav, is the story of the sale of the Bechara, the sale of the birthright by Esav to Yaakov. There's a lot of interesting discussion in the commentaries, both in terms of pshat and just the social aspects of the story, as well as in terms of the halachic and legal aspects of the story, about what exactly was being sold and how is it consistent with the halachas of sales, of contracts in Torah. We'll discuss some of the major theories of the commentary soon. I just want to begin by way of introduction. The story of the sale of Bechara begins. Esav comes in. Esav is exhausted. Esav is starving. He says to Yaakov, give me that stuff. Halitani na, just give me some of that red stuff. And Yaakov says, let's do the Bechara for that. Esav agrees. So there's a famous midrash. Rashi brings one version of it about why Esav was so tired, what had happened on this day, that he had murdered Nimrod to take his begotten chamudos. The Torah later mentions he had special clothes. Esav had murdered Nimrod to steal them. The connection between Esav and Nimrod we've discussed in the past. They're both mentioned as great hunters. Nimrod is Gibor Tzayed Lefnei Hashem. Esav is Ish Tzayed, Tzayed Befiv, Ish Sada, Yedat Tzayed, and so on. So that's the connection, obviously. And Chazal, as the Rebbe Yehuda famously says in his tshuva criticizing recreational hunting, he says the two paradigmatic biblical hunters are Esav and Nimrod. It's not a hobby that a good Jewish boy should choose to put yourself in the company of Esav and Nimrod. However, I noticed a few years ago I came across some remarkable alternate versions of these midrashim, exactly what the connection between Esav and Nimrod was and where the Bigdei Chamudos fell in. So again, Rashi's pshat is that Esav saw them, Esav wanted them, Esav killed Nimrod to steal them. There's another pshat that actually turns the whole thing on its head. It says that Esav was hunting, Nimrod was the master hunter, and this is a very medieval idea. Anyone who's read Robin Hood, anyone who's read the old medieval stories will be familiar with this. Nimrod says, what are you doing hunting? These fields, I'm the king, I'm the chief hunter, no one can hunt here without my permission, this is a capital offense, I'm going to kill you. That's that Robin Hood, everyone is always getting arrested by the corrupt authorities for poaching the king's deer. So according to this version of the Midrash, and here we have another very medieval element, it says Nimrod decided that Esav's fate would be determined by single combat. They would set up a date, and they would battle to the death, and Nimrod, I guess, assumed he would kill Esav, and that would be his punishment for poaching his deer. So according to one version of the Midrash, Esav actually appealed to Yaakov. I don't know how friendly they were until this story, but Esav came into Yaakov and said, I'm desperate, I'm exhausted, I don't know, I'm at my wit's end, I don't know what to do, I have a date for trial by combat with Nimrod, and I can't beat him. And Yaakov told him that he has these special clothes that are going to give him an edge in combat. You have to somehow get him to take them off. How Esav did that, maybe he appealed to his honor, maybe he made him feel... Maybe he taunted him that he couldn't beat him without naked or something, but whatever it was, Esav somehow managed to manipulate Nimrod on Yaakov's advice into removing his Bigdei Chamudos. Then Esav was able to win, according to one version. He actually took them and put them on, and then he had no qualms about cheating and beating Nimrod with his clothes, but one way or another, this tilted on its head. According to Rashi's pshat, he had already killed Nimrod when he went to Yaakov. According to this other pshat, he actually didn't know what to do about Nimrod, and Yaakov told him, go get rid of his Bigdei Chamudos, then you can win, then you can beat him. In any event, there are various stories, again, that connect Nimrod and Esav and the Begadim. The common thread is that they all agree that Esav somehow killed Nimrod and the Begadim were involved. Which was the cause? Which was the effect? Which had happened before the sale? Which had happened after the sale? And I mentioned there are some very medieval motifs in the story. It's hard to know where these Midrashim come from. The earliest Midrashim that we have, going back to Midrash Rabbah, I don't think mentioned the single combat. To the extent of the research I did, these elements first appear in medieval versions of the story. The various Rishonim, the Balei Tosfos, bring these different midrashic accounts. Again, it's a loaded question, obviously, the development of midrash and when they were formulated. But there is a whole school of midrashic interpretations which have to be carefully compared and carefully analyzed. Right, and those begotten themselves were the ones that Yaakov himself used to help get the brachos from. My father has a principle he likes to refer to. he calls it the, you know, kind of the conservation of biblical personalities and themes. A chazal, when they find two people, one of them is not identified, they say, this was Micha, this was that one, this was the kind of the connections between them. And here, the Begadim, Nimrod, Esav, hunting, chazal have a very kind of tight and very coherent interpretation of the Torah. Even when the Torah doesn't always make these connections, chazal are often here to make them for you. So we have the sale of the Bechara. And the commentators disagree. The commentators have various interpretations about what exactly was being sold at the Bechara. But basically, there are three schools of thought, overlapping somewhat. There are three possibilities in what exactly was being sold for the Bechara. There are some who say that it was a spiritual notion, the right to do the avodah, to serve in the temple. Rashi brings this down, that when Esav said, Hinei anochi halech lamus, Esav had a dim view of his life expectancy. He said he was going to die. Rashi brings a midrash that Esav meant the avodah is very dangerous. If you mess up the avodah, Hashem kills you, and therefore I want the avodah. The avodah itself is what would give me this low life expectancy. The whole avodah, the whole Bechara, is not for me. So they, according to this interpretation, the sale of the Bechara had at least something to do with the avodah. We know that eventually it was the prerogative of the Kohanim and Leviim to do the avodah, but that was after the Egel. The Bechorim lost the right, it was transferred, the whole Pidyon we read about in Bamidbar. But that was a later development. At some point, it was going to be the Bechorim, and that was what was involved in the sale. Not going to have too much to say about this. How, can you sell that? I mean, a Kohen today can't sell his kuhuna to anybody else. He can't pay for someone to take it if he doesn't want it. He can't sell it if someone else wants it. Doesn't...
We did the Pidyon before.
Right, we do Pidyon Bechor, although the Mefarshim struggled with that. The Nusach we say at a Pidyon Bechor, the father opens and he tells the Kohen after the Kohen opens, the Kohen tells him, what would you rather have, your son or the money? So the Mefarshim say it's a ritual, it's a formality. The father does not have the option of telling the Kohen, I'm not paying, keep the son. The son has Kedusha. Right, it's a mitzvah, the Torah says we have to do, but there is no real halachic status. There's no major halachic status a Bechor has. If for some reason you didn't do a Binyan HaBen, you forgot, and you discovered later, I don't think the son has any particular halachos either.
But it's indicative that the Bechor is like it's transferred.
Absolutely, yeah, in some sense, yes. It was transferred in a kind of general way back then, and in some sense, the Pidyon, right, Pidyon, the definition of Pidyon Shemitah, Pidyon Ma'aser Sheni, right, does imply that in some sense, but I mean, it isn't transferable on a case-by-case personal basis, it's transferable in a system that turns it up. You're right, there is some way it can be transferred. Maybe that's the root in understanding what was happening here, but this is Rashi, that had to do with the Avodah. Not going to have too much more to say about that. There is a second approach, which is suggested by some of the Mefarshei HaPshat, Ibn Ezra, Rashbam. They say that the Bechor had some kind of social preeminence. The way that Ibn Ezra puts it is, Yesh l'Bechor la'olam ma'ale al atzor, the Bechor has a preeminence over the younger sons. Lakum mipanav, the younger sons actually should rise in his presence. And the younger son should serve him and should honor him like a son, as a son honors a father. Other commentaries say similar things, perhaps not the Rashbam, but other commentaries bring similar ideas. The Torah, I think, brings this, that I cut out part of the Torah for space, but the Torah actually brings the second line of the Torah toward the end, that Torah hakaton linho gedulo srar la'achiv hagadol, Lakum mipanav, to stand up in his presence, ulachabdo, to honor him. Again, can you really sell that? You know, if there's some mitzvah to honor a Bechor, can a father sell his right to be honored to somebody else? I don't know. Again, maybe Bechor is particularly transferable. Again, the legal discussion doesn't really touch that much. It's hard to know if that was a legal transaction at all. The third approach, though, which is the one that the commentators, at least from a legal perspective, spend the most time discussing, is the idea, which is perhaps the simplest approach, that we know, we discussed a few months ago, that in halacha, Bechor has one main significance. Even today, the Bechor gets pishnayim in the inheritance of the estate. He gets a double share. As we explained, if there are a number of children, n children, three children, let's say, you divide the estate into n plus one, into four shares, Bechor gets pishnayim, two, everyone else gets one in this case, so one, one, and two, so the Bechor ends up with twice as much as everyone else. We discussed the possibility of making wills and getting around that. People often do that today. But according to Din Torah, the Torah law of Yerusha, the Bechor gets Pishnayim, and that is what the Yaakov was buying from Esav. He was buying his financial interest in his father's estate. Rav Asher Weiss points out there's actually a Gemara which seems to be assuming this. There is a sensational account in the Talmud, in Sota, of the day of Yaakov's burial. The burial is described in the Chumash, in the end of Parashas Vayechi, that after Yaakov blessed his sons and the Birchas Yaakov, then he died, they embalmed him, they transported him back to Eretz Canaan, they buried him, of course, in Maaret Machpelah. The Talmud has an elaborate, sensational account of what actually happened before the burial was concluded. It said they all went back to Kiryas Ha'arba. It's called Kiryas Ha'arba because Hebron Kiryas Ha'arba, because there are four couples who are buried there: Adam and Chava, Avram and Sarah, Yitzchak and Rivka, and Yaakov and Leah. Rachel, of course, is buried in Kever Rachel elsewhere. But the four couples were Adam and Chava and the three pairs of patriarchs and matriarchs. So the Gemara says that when Yaakov's children carried him with Yosef down from up from Egypt to Eretz Canaan, they wanted to bury him there. Esav showed up. Esav said, not so fast. There were two spots left for our generation. Leah is already there. Leah had predeceased Yaakov. So you Yaakov, you get one. Your family gets one for Leah, and the other one's for me. I want the other one for me or for someone I want to put there. So they said, nope, you don't get it. We get both. They said, you sold it. Zavinte, where did you sell it? Rashi says, Mechiras HaBechara. They said the sale of the Bechara included the rights to Maaret HaMachpelah. So Esav had a sharp legal mind. Esav said, I sold the Bechara. I sold my additional share. So we should be equal. Maybe Yaakov should have had twice at this point, but I didn't sell everything. We're still brothers. I still get something. You still can't take both spots for yourself. So they told him, no, the sale comprehended everything. The sale, I don't know why, but they infer from Sukkim, the sale included the entire Maaret HaMachpelah, so you have no share. So the Talmud goes on. Esav said, show me the paperwork. I didn't quote the whole Gemara. Esav said, show me the Igarta, show me the documentation of the sale. So there's an elaborate story. They sent Naphtali. We don't have it. We left it back in Egypt. We didn't expect to have to engage in paperwork at the grave. So Naphtali went back to Egypt to fetch the papers. Naphtali is Ayala Shlucha. He was a swift of foot, a swift runner. And all the story eventually resulting in Esav's death. Esav's death, and his head ended up in Maaret HaMachpelah. But the point is that the Gemara clearly understands there might not have been all that was involved in the sale, but at least a component of the sale was real estate, was the property. Who owned the Maaret HaMachpelah at this time? Parshas told us Yitzchak did, presumably. And in other words, the sale, partly or wholly, was a sale of the inheritance that the brothers stood to inherit from their father, Yitzchak. This is also the assumption of the Ibn Ezra, perhaps the Ramban, and the Rashbam, the Tur, a number of Rishonim all assume that at least the primary part of the sale, a primary part, the sale was about property, was about the inheritance they stood to inherit from their father. The Ibn Ezra, he mentions also the social preeminence, he also mentions the property. He says, Holech Lamus, what does Holech Lamus mean? What did Esav mean by his pessimistic perspective on his longevity? So he says a pshat, which the Rashbam also brings from his father, Rabbi Meir. Rashbam is Rabbi Shmuel ben Meir. Rashbam cites this in the name of his father. And other commentaries, the Bali Tosfos say this too. Esav meant, my career is a hunter. Hunting is dangerous. I go out to the forest with bears and lions and dangerous animals, and I don't expect to live all that long. When we discuss hunting, so the Nodeb Yehuda famously invokes this as another reason to be opposed to hunting, besides the fact that it is bad character. It goes against the character of a Jew of being gentle and compassionate. He also says that hunting is dangerous, so a person needs to do it to make a living. All right, a person has the right to take risks to earn his daily bread, but the Pashup Shadi says it's dangerous, and hunting for recreation is an unconscionably dangerous thing to do. Obviously, it depends on the context and how you're hunting, but hunting is dangerous, and therefore, Holech Lamos, Esav meant, hunting is dangerous, and therefore he meant, what is Bechara? Bechara means I inherit when my father dies. I have to live long enough to benefit from that. Esav said, I don't expect to live all that long. My father, I guess, is sedentary. He stays home. He has a quiet life. He should live a long time. I'm out there in the fields. Any day, I'll be killed by a lion. Therefore, I have no use for the Bechara. Ibn Ezra takes for granted, again, that seems to assume here that the primary point of the Bechara is to inherit, and the Bechara has no value during the father's lifetime. The Ramban also uses this language, Ein lebechara shum ma'ala rak achrei ha'av, putting aside the social preeminence thing. They say certainly financially the Bechara has no significance while the father is alive, And therefore, Esav said, you know, actuarially, I don't expect to benefit from this, so not worth anything to me. Now, the Menazer and the Ramban now have a fascinating and somewhat intricate argument as to why, beyond this question of Esav didn't expect to live long enough, the Ibn Ezra also says that Esav didn't care about the Bechara. Another reason was because Yitzchak had no money. And inheritance is only worth something if the person who, if the tested or the person who has the money has money. If he had no money, then the Bechara is not really useful. So he says, Ibn Ezra says Yitzchak was poor. Therefore, his inheritance was not worth anything. Why does Ibn Ezra think Yitzchak was poor? He brings a number of curious arguments to that effect. First of all, he addresses the fact that Avram, we mentioned last week, the matriarchs are all described as being beautiful, the patriarchs are all described as being rich. Avram was rich, so he says, why wouldn't Yitzchak have had money? So he says, what kind of question is that? You've never seen someone who has a fortune and then goes broke? He says, that's a common thing. Yitzchak had lost all his money. How do we know he lost all his money? He says, well, Yitzchak was very fond of Esav because he brought him food. That means he needed food. That means the food was important to him. That means he simply, you know, food wasn't plentiful in Yitzchak's house. Furthermore, he says when Yaakov ran to Lavan, he ran with nothing. Rivka didn't send him any care packages. Didn't send him a couple of truckloads of stuff. He had to work literally day and night, as the pasuk says, for Lavan. He had nothing. Why couldn't they send him something? They didn't have anything. There wasn't money to go around in Yitzchak's house, even though later in the parashas told us it talks about Avimelech v'yigdal ha'ish, he became rich. That was later. So Yitzchak may have started out rich, or Avram started out rich, and Yitzchak later was rich. But at this point in his life, Yitzchak was not worth much economically and financially, and therefore Esav didn't care about the Bechara. The Ibn Ezra goes on and makes a very curious point. He says, theologically, some people have a hard time with the notion that a tzaddik like Yitzchak would have been so poor. They say, Osher is a malef for tzaddikim. You think Hashem would give it to them. They go on, why would Hashem not give money to Yitzchak? So the Ben Ezra says, why would Hashem? He says, he can't ask questions. We don't know why Hashem does or doesn't do things. Yitzchak was blind also, he says. He clearly didn't have an easy life. But Pashup Shah, Yitzchak had a tough life. You can't ask questions about why Hashem runs the world. Tzaddik v'ralo, Rasha v'tovlo. We don't always understand how Hashem does things. His ways are deep. His ways are profound. Not for us to know. Regarding the question of, is it reasonable to say Yitzchak was poor? Ibn Ezra has a very curious comment. He says, Eliyahu Yochiach. So, as I always mention, the Rishonim often assume that you know your Tanakh well, certainly a lot better than I do. It seems Ibn Ezra is assuming that Eliyahu HaNavi was poor. So, why do we assume Eliyahu HaNavi was poor? It's unclear. The Torah doesn't describe him anywhere directly as being poor. It seems, Shemel brings, one of the commentaries says, we know he's described as wearing a girdle of hide, Azar Ar. This was apparently Eliyahu's signature calling card. It says when Achav once asked, Eliyahu appeared somewhere, Achav asked the messengers, who did you meet, who was it? So they said, well, he was a hairy person, Ish Sear, and he was wearing an Azar Ar. Oh, that's Eliyahu. Everyone knew Eliyahu wore this belt of hide. I mean, we wear belts of leather also. I'm not sure what's so significant about that, but someone suggests maybe that was a poor man's garment. It was untreated ar, maybe it was coarse ar. Someone else says that when Eliyahu first ran for his life, Eliyahu's first appearance in Tanakh is that, under his own name at least, is that when Eliyahu tells Achav, I'm telling you there will be no rain for 3 years. Achav gets really upset and Eliyahu runs for his life. So Hashem says, that tells Eliyahu, go hide at this river and drink water from the river, and the arvim, the birds, will bring you meat and so on, and you'll survive over there. So they say, Ibn Ezra thought, he means he didn't have any money. He had to live off the birds. I mean, he was on the run. He didn't have any money because his bank accounts were frozen by Achav. So I don't know if we can really infer he was poor. Just a very curious thing. If you stop and think about it, again, I don't claim to any serious knowledge of Tanakh, but if I were to ask you, who in Tanakh do we know was poor? Which great tzaddik do we know was poor? Ibn Ezra apparently can't think of anyone except for Eliyahu. I mean, Eov obviously had trouble when Hashem, brought all the tribulations on him. But Ibn Ezra apparently can't think of any example of someone, of a great tzaddik, a great Navi in Tanakh who was poor, except Eliyahu, who he has these kind of oblique implications from the Torah that he was a poor man. All right, that's what Ibn Ezra says. Yitzchak was poor, and that's why, just like Eliyahu, and that's one reason Esav didn't particularly care about the Bechara. The Ramban has a very vehement rebuttal of this Ibn Ezra. As we've discussed previously, the Ramban does not like a lot of things Ibn Ezra says, and generally because either because he's being dismissive toward Chazal or the Jewish tradition, or being this is a kind of colloquial and imprecise way to say this, but roughly speaking, because he's not being firm enough, is usually the reason that the Ramban rejects things that Ibn Ezra says. In this case, I don't know exactly what it was that rubbed him the wrong way. He may have just had technical objections to it, but the Ramban spends a lot of time rebutting the Ibn Ezra's assertions that Yitzchak was poor. He says that to say he was rich and poor and rich again is just, you know, is just unreasonable, he says. And he goes on bringing arguments that he was that he was rich, that he was Ibn Ezra's counter-arguments are wrong and his defenses are wrong, and he goes on and on arguing that the Hashem took care of the Avos, and they were all like Malachim, he says, and they were all doing well, and they were not having financial trouble, and so on. And he rebuts the Ibn Ezra at some length. And one of the things that the Ramban proposes, though, which is an important point, is that Yitachein ki pi shnayim bebechara b'mishpatei ha-Torah lo haya kein lefanim. Who says the whole idea of Bechara, to inherit pi shnayim, was relevant at all back then? Ibn Ezra is assuming it was financial. Says Ramban, who says? Maybe it means the other aspect, malas ha'avs for us. So Ramban already is telling us that we can't necessarily assume that all the halacha that we know from Talmud and Shulchan Aruch all carries over to these transactions back here in Parashas Toldos. That's something we'll return to soon. But that the Ramban goes on like that. One other very interesting point in this Ramban is that one of Ibn Ezra's arguments that Yitzchak was poor is that he cared so much about Esav's tzayid. And in particular, Ibn Ezra says, right before Yitzchak wished to bless Esav, which eventually we know Yaakov took, but right before he blessed Esav, he sent him out. He said, Haveli matamim, bring me some delicacies, bring me some good food, hunt me something, bring me some good food. Ibn Ezra says, why was food so important to him? Because he was poor and didn't have food. This is probably what the Ramban doesn't like. It's kind of cutting Yitzchak down to size. It's making him seem like a poor and desperate and this worldly individual who's obsessed with food. That's probably a lot of what Ramban does not like. So the Ramban says, no, you know why he wanted food? Not because he was poor. He was very rich, he says. You know why he wanted food? He gives a couple of suggestions. One reason, he says, is because he wanted, when a Navi gives someone a blessing, when a Navi wants to prophecy regarding someone, he wants to, both of Ramban's ideas are kind of Hasidic in spirit, but he says one idea is he wanted to feel a connection to Esav. He wanted, obviously he was his beloved son, he knew him for years, but he wanted to feel a kind of immediate and heightened connection to Esav, so he wanted him to bring him something which he would eat, so he would feel particularly close to him at this moment. Another idea, he says, is that I'm not familiar with Hasidic culture, but Hasidim, I think, when they go to the Rebbe, if they want a bracha, they often bring a pidyon, some sum of money, more or less. So again, you know, people have complained about this practice, but again, I think part of the theory is that by giving the Rebbe something, the tzaddik something, it creates some kind of connection between them. It allows the Rebbe to help him and empathize with him in a way that's you know, better than he would be able to do otherwise. Second pshat the Ramban brings, also a little bit Hasidic, is that he says that a Navi, in order to have his Nevuah, in order to reach the exalted spiritual state for Nevuah, he needs to be in a particularly joyous frame of mind. So he says, in order to have Ruach HaKodesh, he needs something to make him happy and cheerful. So that was the food. And he says, similarly, we find a pasuk about Elisha. Elisha once said, "Kechuli menagein," fetch me a musician, he said. V'hoya kenagein ha-menagein, when the musician played, v'ti alav yad Hashem. Then he had Ruach HaKodesh, Nevuah. He needed to be in an exalted frame of mind in order to have Nevuah. So here also, Yitzchak wanted the connection with the divine, so he needed to be in a heightened frame of mind, which was accomplished via food. Now the Ralbag, I didn't print it here, but the Ralbag vehemently rejects this. The Ralbag says, some people say that he wanted the food to put himself into a happy and elevated frame of mind. Ramban says, Chas v'shalom, he says. Elisha, music is a kind of spiritual thing, the arts, it appeals to the mind, and it's an abstract thing. Food, he says, physical and coarse and gashmias, he says, that's not what a Navi does to put himself into an exalted frame of mind. And as I said, you know, I was, you know, half joking about Hasidus, but that really is the root of their argument here. This goes back to the medieval period. There were great debates among different schools of Jewish thought as to whether how much value to place on the physical. The more Kabbalistic tradition, which eventually influenced the Hasidim, obviously, the more Kabbalistic, mystic Hasidic traditions always felt that the physical, when utilized correctly, in a permissible way, of course, and with a proper frame of mind, that it's in the service of God, and so on, can be a lofty thing. Hashem gave us the physical. There's nothing to be embarrassed about. It's part of life, and that's part of life, and there's nothing wrong with it. Nothing to be embarrassed about. While the more philosophical, the Aristotelian certainly, the Rambam and others have always had a great distaste for the physical. They always thought it was a necessary evil. It's something that we have to tolerate while we're here in this world, but that's partly why they argue about Olam Haba, whether it's going to be with bodies or without bodies. The Rambam vehemently rejects the notion that our bodies are going to be permanent in Olam Haba. Bodies are just coarse and they drag us down. While the Ramban and others say there will be bodies, bodies are also God's handiwork. They are part of the ideal, the way God made people. This is kind of a reflection of that, where people like the Ralbag, who are working within the hardline Aristotelian tradition, had no use for the physical. If you want to be happy, fine, do it through music, but not through food. While the Ramban had no problem saying that a great Navi like Yitzchak would have appreciated a little food to put him into a more spiritually congenial frame of mind.
It's interesting that you mentioned that, because the Gemara, as quoted by the Rambam in his Yad, that the Simcha of Chagim is in fact Basar.
Right.
But the Simcha of Chagim is not the contemplation of our closeness to God, or the notion Kibiyachol we would be on a regel. That would be my approach.
That's a fair point. That's a fair point. It's not as black. It's certainly not as black and white as I just made it. But this is a machlokas here between the Ben Ezra, the Ramban, and the Ralbag, whether it's acceptable to say that Yitzchak would have wanted matamim simply to put himself into a spiritually receptive frame of mind. So all these Rishonim are suggesting that the sale of the Bechara had to do with the Ramban, maybe not the Ramban, but the Ben Ezra, the Rashbam, the Tur. As we'll see soon, are all assuming that the sale of the Bechara had to do with Yitzchak's estate, about who would inherit it. The Gemara seems to say that, as Rav Asher Weiss points out, about the sale of Maris Machpelah, that they stood to inherit down the line. Now, the Rishonim have a problem with this. And this is the phrase I use as the title for this talk. There is a rule in Halacha that you cannot sell something you do not own. Eina democher davar she'eina shelo. You cannot sell something which is not yours. In Latin, I don't even begin to know how to pronounce it, something like nemo dat quod non habet. One cannot give something he does not have, which, now obviously, in a very basic sense, it goes without saying. The whole notion of private property is that if it's mine, you can't just give it away to somebody else without asking me. The law actually goes further, apparently. The law says that even in cases where, let's say, the buyer bought it in good faith and sold it to somebody else in good faith, and it doesn't matter, the point is, None of the buyers, no matter how innocent they are, none of the buyers have any title to it. It was sold without their permission. It was sold without the original owner's permission. The sales are all void. Can't sell something which you don't own. Halacha actually has a very similar rule. Anything you buy, no matter how good the faith was, it's not yours. The original owner retains title. The law and halacha both have certain exceptions to, just for practical reasons, for purchasers in good faith, because in halacha we call it takanas hashuk, that if we don't let people keep things they bought, it would put a kind of damper on commerce. If you have to do a title search anytime you bought anything, it would just, we do that for real estate, but in other areas it's net less practical. So halacha does say in certain cases that if you buy something in good faith, you're entitled to demand compensation from the owner before you turn it over to him. But in general, halacha and the law certainly say you cannot sell something you do not have. Halacha goes further, and I don't know what the legal perspective on this is, but halacha goes further and has a rule called literally, you cannot sell something or give something which does not yet exist, meaning even if you try to sell it in such a way that the transfer shall take effect when it does come la'olam, when it does become yours, it comes into the world and becomes yours, still doesn't work. If at the time of the sale, the property does not yet exist or does exist and does not belong to you, sale is not valid. So for example, if I have a field, and I say, okay, next 10 years of crops, I want to raise money against these crops now. I'm selling to you the crops of the next 10 years. Can't do that. Crops don't exist yet. Can't sell it. Similarly, if I tell you that even if it does exist, I say tomorrow I'm going to go and buy a car and I want to sell that car to you today. Can't do that. The car might exist. It's not my car today. Can't sell it to you. The sale is not even valid when I get the car. Since at the time of the sale it was not mine, the sale is not valid. This is the rule of Einan Democher Davar Shlo Ba'olam. You cannot enter into a sale if the assets you're trying to sell do not currently exist. Now, there are a number of complications, and there are ways to work around this. In the examples I gave, for example, about a field or a tree and crops, there are ways to actually transfer an interest in the field or an interest in the tree itself and the field itself exist, and I own them already. I can kind of lease to you the tree or transfer some kind of ownership interest in the tree such that you'll be entitled to the crop. So in certain cases, there are ways around it. But when it comes to inheritance, you have nothing today. All the property belongs to your father. You have zero. You have no interest whatsoever in this property. You cannot sell such property. The sale will not be valid. Even if you don't retract till the father dies, it doesn't matter. The sale is not valid. And that's at least the law of the Talmud, the law in the Shulchan Aruch. So the question is, again, assuming this was the law, assuming that the Yaakov and Esav and their family were following Torah law, how would such a sale have been valid? This question was first raised by the Tur, or his father, the Rush. A number of other medieval sources. The truth is, recently they found that there's actually what purports to be a Gaonic responsum that addresses this question, but generally this was first raised, widely known to be raised in the medieval period. Legally speaking, how is such a sale valid? So one approach, which is the approach of the Rivash, was writing in the 14th century, one approach is that the law before Matan Torah was different. Now, you can really say this in two ways. One way to say it is that certain halachas changed at Matan Torah. You can say more generally that Torah law itself, that before the Torah, they simply followed local laws, that whatever customs were practiced in Canaan or practiced in the Middle East at that time. Either way, you can argue that the laws they were following were not the laws of halacha at the time, not the laws, certainly not the laws of halacha as it would be established later. They were following other laws. This is basically the approach of the Rivash, who says that Kodem HaDibur, we don't know, he says, but who says? Maybe Kodem HaDibur, there was no rule of Davar Shelo Bo La'olam. That's certainly one way, the simplest way to understand this transaction. We simply don't expect it to follow the laws of the Torah. The Rush, as quoted by his son, the Tur, yes.
And it's like pick your time. I mean,
This is a very good question. I don't really have an answer for the consistency. So first of all, you're going to find some of it is a question of which commentator, which school of thought. You certainly are going to find some of the more pshat oriented or rationalistically oriented commentaries who take for granted they were not following Torah law at the time. They followed local custom, whatever the custom was. For example, there is a passage by very brief comment, but a comment by Rabbi Avram, the son of the Rambam, who says, a couple of parashiyos down the line, Parashas Vayishlach, it says that Yaakov said, get rid of all the idols that you may have in your possession and get rid of them, bury them under the tree, destroy them, whatever it is, get rid of the idols. So the Rabbi Avram says, this is the kind of thing that the rabbis of the Talmud meant when they said that the patriarchs followed the Torah, they followed the mitzvahs that are rational and that monotheists of the time would have understood and would have been expected to, that intelligent and upright and moral people would have followed. Not that they did things like eat Pesach and do the specific mitzvahs that, based on events that happened later. Chazal themselves, if you read the Midrashim, don't seem to say that. They seem to be saying, taking literally, that they did follow the Tariq mitzvahs. But there definitely were schools of thought, certainly of the more, more rationalist-minded commentators, that they were not following actual Torah law. Now, within the more traditional, more Talmudic schools of thought that they did generally follow Torah law, then you have to deal with the exceptions, as you're pointing out. So the Ramban has a famous discussion of Yaakov marrying sisters and so on. You know, there are a whole string of various apparent violations of Torah law that they found. And that's a good question. The question then becomes, is it possible to create any consistent and straightforward rule that accounts for when they did and when they didn't? One approach is the approach of the Ramban, that outside Eretz Israel they did not, inside Eretz Israel they did. This would have happened inside Eretz Israel, in which case I guess you'd expect that they would have followed Torah law. Yeah, but the broader question, you're right. I'm not really prepared to get into a systematic discussion of who assumed they did, who assumed they didn't, to what extent yes and to what extent not. But you're right. But the one point, just in a vacuum at least, is the Rivash's idea that they did not follow, at least this particular law of the Torah may not have applied before Matan Torah. But the Rush, the Torah and the Rush, did not assume this. They took for granted that the Avos, the patriarchs, their children, would have been following Torah law. So how exactly does this work if under Torah law this would not have been a valid transaction? So the Rush says something interesting. The Rush says, the Pasuk says, the Esav took an oath. Yaakov said, he shavali. swear to me that you're going to respect and, you know, keep this trend, keep your end of the bargain. Vayishavalo, he did. Says the Rush, the defect of a contract of being Dovr Shlomo La'olam can be repaired with an oath. If you back up your transaction with an oath, that can fix the problem. I mentioned that modern writers point out that there's a Gaonic response that says this. The context actually is a little bit lurid. There's a tshuva they printed ostensibly from the Gaonim. The case was somebody apparently, again, the text is a little bit corrupt, so it's not entirely clear what he was saying, but it sounds like somebody had been beating his wife. And they forced him to agree contractually that he would, if he did it again, if he had better stop, and if he did it one more time, he would suffer, he would forfeit his financial rights, he would be hit by some grave penalty. And then he did it again, and the question was, is this contract binding? So there was some question, the contract had not been properly executed, didn't have a proper Kenyan or something, there were some defects in the contract. So the Gaon said, doesn't matter, he took an oath. An oath can repair what would otherwise be faults in a contract. If the oath is very strong in halacha, the oath can repair failings in contracts. That's proof, he says, that's precedent. Look at the story of Yaakov and Esau. There would have been a problem of Dovr Shlomo La'olam. It was solved by the oath, and this is what the Rush says too. The Torah cites his father, the Rush, as saying that the problem is solved by the oath. So you see, the whole problem of Dovr Shlomo La'olam can be erased if you back it up with an oath. This is a very powerful principle. If you accept this notion that problematic contracts can be repaired and corrected by oath, that gives us a lot of power in structuring contracts in halacha to do it in ways that would avoid the whole problem of Dovr Shlomo La'olam, and really a whole family of problems could be solved by taking oaths. The Rivash is very, very unhappy about this idea. When someone told him the Rush said this, he says he doesn't believe it. It's not authoritative. It's illogical, and therefore it can't be the Rush said it. And he says, I'm not aware of any authoritative account of the Rush saying this. As I mentioned earlier, where the Rush says this is in the commentary of the Tur on the Torah. The commentary of the Tur on the Torah is an interesting work. Many of us are familiar with the Bala Turim. The Bala Turim, published in many Chumashim, was quite a popular work for centuries. The Bala Turim was written apparently as a kind of teaser or as a kind of introduction to his more serious work, which was the work of the Tur ala Torah. The Tur is a kind of very bread and butter work. It's pshat, largely an anthology. Quotes, most of it is quoting from earlier sources. Some of it is his own, but in this case, this is the Rush. We have no other source for. The Tur wrote this kind of sober-minded, down-to-earth, serious work ala Torah. He wrote the Bala Turim, which are these creative and interesting and ingenious works of Gematria and Drush and other, about the Masara, which he wrote apparently as a kind of flavoring and dessert kind of for his sober-minded work, Ala Torah. You know, popularity is as popularity does. The Bala Turim became very popular. The Torah itself was not published, not widely known until relatively recently where they found manuscripts and they republished it. So the Rivash, we don't know what he saw. Someone told him the Torah says this in the name of the Rush. Rivash says, I don't believe it. I don't accept it. Today we do have this manuscript, which is widely believed to be authentic and is actually the work of the Torah, in which case we know that the Rush did say it, if we assume this is reliable. So in any event, we have a machlokas between what seems to be the Torah and the Rush, also supported by the Tshuva of the Gaon, if that's reliable, against the Rivash, who says no such thing. We have a machlokas whether something like Dovr Shlomo La'olam can be repaired by an oath. Just one practical application of Dovr Shlomo La'olam, a place where many of us run into it in an actual practical context, this has to do with the sale of chametz. So we know the way this is done today is typically we appoint the rabbi, our agent, to sell our chametz. The actual sale occurs later. It occurs typically on Erev Pesach or Bedikas Chametz night. The sale itself with the rabbi goes to the non-Jew and sells chametz later, but we delegate the Rav, we appoint the rabbi as our agent. You know, they have hours commonly, a week or two before Pesach, and you go whenever it's convenient for you and the rabbi, and you make him your agent to sell the chametz. Now, in the 19th century, many poskim raised an objection to this arrangement. They raised a lot of objections, but one of the objections they raised was the issue of Dovr Shlomo La'olam. How so? Let's say a person meets the rabbi a week before Pesach and appoints him as agent to sell his chametz. So fine, all the chametz he already owns, he could sell on that day if he wants. He therefore has the power to delegate the rabbi as his proxy to sell the chametz. But let's say he gets more chametz afterward. Let's say in the week between the meeting with the rabbi and Pesach, he buys new chametz. Whether it's his business, he gets a shipment of new merchandise. whether it's personally he buys another box of Cheerios or something for his family. So in these cases, had he himself tried to sell that chametz a week earlier, it wouldn't have worked, because that chametz was davrish lo balolam, davrishena brishuso. Even if it existed, he didn't own the chametz yet, so the sale itself wouldn't have worked, even though the sale is not actually taking place till Erev Pesach, and nobody's really buying chametz that late already, but that doesn't matter, because the halacha also is you can't even, the rule of davrish lo balolam extends to the appointment of an agent. You can't even appoint an agent, the poskim say, on something which is lo balolam, to sell something which is lo balolam. So many poskim raised this very serious objection to the sale of chametz with regard to any chametz that was purchased after the meeting with the Rav, that the agency shouldn't work, the sale shouldn't work, therefore, for any chametz that was bought after the formal delegation of the rabbi. So there are a lot of ways around this. There are a lot of different arguments why this might not be a problem. None of them are foolproof. It really is a serious question. There is no absolutely solid, universally accepted answer. In theory, if we had this, if we accepted this idea of the Rush, that an oath can repair flaws of davrish lo balolam, this would be a good trick. We could simply add an oath to the language of the appointment of the rabbi. Now, practically, we wouldn't do this because we Ashkenazim in particular are very, very reluctant to make oaths. It so happens that if you study historically contracts that were used by Jews historically, Sfardim in particular used to frequently add languages of oaths into their contracts. They used to often say, the borrower is borrowing the sum of $10,000, and he commits to paying it back by this date, and he takes an oath that he swears that he will pay it back by this date. And this was very common. And there's a lot of literature on the Sfardic Svarim. What if he didn't actually take the oath? Is an oath in writing a valid oath? What if something goes wrong? Does he still violate the oath or not? They took these oaths frequently as a means of strengthening contracts. Ashkenazim, much less so. Ashkenazim, today, it's virtually unheard of. Sfardim still do take oaths with regard to some of their contracts. The most prominent is the ksuva. We know that we've discussed previously, Sfardim do not all have the same relationship with Rabbeinu Gershom's bans of polygamy and unilateral divorce that we Ashkenazim do. So many Sfardim, the custom had become, going back to the medieval period, they would add their own language into the ksuva that they would accept, the chassan would voluntarily accept the prohibition against polygamy. And very often that would be buttressed with an oath. The chassan would say, I swear that I will not, will not mistreat her, I will not marry another woman, I will not divorce her unilaterally, and so on. And this is just an example of what was a pretty common practice, that the Sfardim would often buttress their contracts with oaths. So the question we have with the machlokes between the Rosh and the Rivash is, if there is some serious flaw in the contract, such as davrish lo balolam, can that flaw be corrected by an oath? The Rosh and the Tur, the Gaon, say yes. The Rivash says no. In terms of the theoretical argument, what they're really arguing about, Rav Asher Weiss and earlier Achronim, Rav Chana Wasserman and others of Shlomo Eger have pointed out, there are really two ways to understand these kinds of, anyone who's learned the Talmud and the Shulchan Aruch knows we have all kinds of these very formal technical flaws of contracts, davrish lo balolam, davrish eino b'reshuso, asmachta, the requirement of a kinyan in the first place, the act we do with the pen. Halacha has all kinds of very technical, very formal requirements for how to do contracts. So there's a fundamental dispute with regard to many of them. Are these problems, these are just kind of rules, arbitrary rules that the Torah established, or are these all points that speak to the Gemira's Das, that speak to the proper meaning of the minds? Is Halacha telling you that absent certain formalities or in situations of lo balolam, we don't believe the person really makes up his mind? What you don't see, you're not really committed about. If you don't own it now, you don't really mean to sell it. So some poskim understand it's primarily about Gemira's Das, that a person doesn't really, Chazal understood, a person doesn't really commit himself to selling something he doesn't own, and so on. Other poskim say it's just a law, it's just these are the rules, these are the kind of the axioms, the postulates of Kinyanim, you have to have them, and that's it, it's irreducible, you just have to have these conditions. The Rivash, they suggest, understood, these are just fundamental axioms, these are the rules, you have to have these things for Kinyanim. Without that, it doesn't work. You can have all the oaths in the world. If you're missing a piece of the kinyan, then you don't have a kinyan. If you're missing the rule, if you're violating the rule of davrish lo balolam, your transaction simply will not work. While the Rush, the school of the Rush, they say, understands that none of these rules are inherently necessary. They were all established by the Talmud as manifestations of Gemira's Das. They're all just rules that were meant to ensure a person really, really means to do what he's doing. A person understands exactly what he's doing and then they establish these barriers. The person doesn't own it yet. He doesn't really know what he's doing. He doesn't really commit himself to it yet. Insofar as a person backs something up with an oath was always assumed to have that it was something that was taken very, very seriously by everyone involved. So the assumption was that an oath would would get to the underlying question of Gemara's Das, of assuring us that we have an absolute meaning of the minds, and none of these technicalities matter if we can find some other route to get to Gemara's Das. In any event, this is a big machlokas. Halacha l'maaseh, again, we don't really take oaths today, so the oath itself is not that relevant, but fundamentally, the key question of whether the problem of lo bala olam is a pure, irreducible technical requirement, or simply a symptom or a problem that indicates a lack of Gemara's Das, has many other ramifications, a little bit beyond the scope of this talk, but one of them is, and this is very practical, is, this happens all the time, literally all the time, is when there is a minhag, when there is a commercial custom in the circles in which the participants are moving to honor a certain kind of transaction which would not be valid under halacha. This is probably true in most transactions we have today where American law tells us when transactions are valid or not, and American law very often will consider a transaction valid, even if according to halacha it suffers from some kind of flaw such as lo bala olam. So there's a great deal of literature on this question of whether the minhag overrides the deficiency of halachic technicalities. Some poskim say no, some poskim say yes. And again, one of the reasons for yes is that there are various ways to explain the opinion of yes, but one of the reasons is that that kinyanim are not gzeiros hakasuv, that it's not like basar b'chalav or melacha Shabbos where the Torah gives us rules. Kinyanim is all about gemiras das. Ultimately, all we really care about is ascertaining that the parties had an absolute airtight conviction, commitment to do the transaction. Insofar as the minhag says that this is the way things are done here, people approach things within the framework of minhag. If the minhag is that this is recognized as a valid transaction, then the people mean it too. And therefore, again, we've done an end run around the need for the halakh technicalities. Just as Shvua can repair these problems, so too minhag can repair these problems. Again, there are other theories by which minhag might work, but this, again, is a major point that comes up all the time in dealing with halakhic contracts that are not valid under secular law. Do we say, or vice versa, they are valid under secular law, they're not valid under halacha, can we replace the halakhic technicalities by Gemiras Das, established by an external mechanism such as Shvua, or such as prevailing custom?